Ready.
Oh, I thought you said you were ready.
Yeah, I said we're going to kick off at 1.
Oh, okay. Your mic's still on there. You want to hold off for a sec? Can you hear me?
Intentions.
This is it.
That's really what is good intention.
Call a House Committee on Healthcare to order for this sunny 22nd of March and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2767. We'll go on without your... Oh, here it comes. Hold on. Usually I forget about you when you're sitting here.
Cover that. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2767. Excuse me.
Here somewhere. Yep.
House Bill 2767 requires the Public Employees Benefit Board to conduct pilot projects over 2 years on at least 10 public employees' health when utilizing the walking workstations. It appropriates money from the general fund to purchase at least 10 walking workstations to carry out that pilot project.
Representative Thompson, you want to briefly kick us off?
Yes, Chair Greenlee, thank you. For the record, Jim Thompson, State Representative from House District 23. I'm going to be very, very brief because we have an expert, some expert testimony online that is somebody not in the Capitol, so we can come back for more detail later. This is kind of an interesting bill that Anthony Behrens brought to me, which, by the way, I'll put it on the record if he doesn't. This is a constituent bill. Anthony's a constituent of mine, even though he appears frequently before this committee. This is not a bill connected with his employment. But the concept is...
In fact, he's here on a furlough day.
The concept that caught my attention was that we talk a lot about improving the health of Oregonians, state workers, all kinds of people as we do the healthcare transformation, but we're not talking much about what we're going to do about that. And this is, I think, kind of an interesting concept of something that's been tried, does work, and might provide some benefits. So with that, I'm going to leave it and turn it over to Anthony, and you'll be able to see on the video here pretty quick what we're talking about.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Vice Chair Kenny Geyer, I want to thank Representative Thompson and the committee for agreeing to hear this bill. I'm super excited about it, as Representative Thompson indicated, that I speak only for myself and not for my employer. And I'm super, super excited to have Dr. James Levine here via Skype. And I just want to introduce him real quick, and then I'll let him take over, because he really is an expert in the field. He is, Dr. Levine is the Director of Obesity Solutions at the Mayo Clinic at Arizona State University. He is a Mayo Clinic Professor of Medicine, the Richard Emslander Professor of Nutrition and Metabolism, a Professor of Physiology, a Professor of Health Solutions and Life Sciences, and a Dean's Distinguished Professor of Medicine at Case Western Reserve University. Dr. Levine holds licenses from the General Medical Council of the United Kingdom, a medical license from the state of Minnesota, and certifications from the Diplomat American Boards of Internal Medicine, Nutrition Specialists, and Internal Medicine, Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism. He received his Bachelor of Science, Doctor of Philosophy, and Doctor of Medicine from the Royal Free Hospital School of Medicine in London. He did his residency in internal medicine at the Mayo Graduate School of Medicine, and was a fellow in endocrinology there as well. He's the winner of numerous national and international awards and has been named as an expert by the World Health Organization and the United Nations. Dr. Levine holds a number of patents, has written 3 books, and has authored over 140 academic research and medical papers. And it's my distinct pleasure to... Doctor, you're up. Can you hear us okay?
I can hear you wonderfully. Chair Greenlick, ladies and gentlemen of the panel, thank you for inviting me. It is such a delight and honor to be here. May I please applaud to quote you, rather than talking about solutions, considering how to implement them. Of course, these opinions are my professional opinions, but not necessarily those of the Mayo Clinic or Arizona State University. I'm holding up here a graph, and I will talk through it, but just to show you what it actually looks like. What that is since 1990, the mounting scientific evidence regarding the health consequences of sedentary behavior. In 2012 alone, more than 1,300 scientific peer-reviewed publications were published that spoke to the health consequences of too much sedentariness, ranging from diabetes, hypertension, and obesity, through low mood, cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, that's going to cut him out.
Premature mortality. Therefore, it is incumbent upon us to contemplate solutions that give people the opportunity to be up and mobile, as in fact the body needs to be. One of their multiple solutions, and what I generally recommend, not knowing the specific opportunity here, is to contemplate pilot studies, whether they are in walking desks, I'm on one right now, or whether they involve walking programs throughout the work. But I'm here to provide testimony and to answer your questions.
Some questions. I guess this does.
Is that the end of your testimony, Doctor?
Should you have any?
Doctor, could you hear the chair? Can you hear us?
I can hear you, but I'm leaning in to listen.
Okay. The chair asked if you had any additional testimony.
Only to say that we've had extensive experience of deploying these types of programs and universally have seen either positive responses from employees, improved health, or improved productivity. And that ends my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anthony, are you going to talk more about what it might take to do this pilot study, or do we have it?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I can absolutely talk some more about that if that's of interest to the committee. or if there are any questions for the doctor about kind of the health benefits of moving, or really what the specific issues are that are involved with sitting too often, we can do that as well. It's really chairs.
Well, that's interesting questions like what does it cost to put in place a walking workstation? Those kind of questions as well.
Sure, Chair Greenlink, members of the committee. So the research I've done indicates that the range in cost for these machines can really go anywhere, and we're talking retail from $500 to $4,000. $4,000 is a pretty nice all-encompassing solution. But I think on average, you're probably looking around $750 per unit, sort of on the lower end, and maybe up to $1,500, $2,000 on the mid range. I think those are definitely some upfront costs, but in the end, I think you're looking at least the hope is that you're looking at recouping those costs and even more. It looks like the doctor has
1 minute.
Could I please respectfully add a comment, Chair Greenlink and members of the committee? The comment is that please consider, too, the cost of standard office chairs at the moment. And they can range anywhere from $400 or $500 all the way up to $1,500. So the costs at around $400 to $700 are actually quite reasonable, particularly for a pilot program where all states are replacing office chairs at any given point in time.
If I may, I'm sorry, Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, a way to think about this, at least beyond the pilot, is, you know, depending on the results of the study, these stations can be worked, can be used communally almost. You could have them in meeting rooms, you could have them set up so if someone has to write a report or they're on a conference call, they could go to the walking workstation, and that's where they could do that for a few hours. If you were to be on one of these for 2 to 3 hours, and Dr. Levine can correct me if I'm wrong, but you would essentially be able to get the 10,000 steps that's recommended in that amount of time, and as you can see, Dr. Levine's at his desk right now. He's testifying, and perhaps he can talk a little bit more about his productivity and how he does, if it pleases the chair and the committee.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, with pleasure. Speaking personally, of course, I've seen no decrement in productivity, but more importantly, the studies to date do not show decrement in productivity. Interestingly, it goes without saying, as you would expect, there are health benefits. What is interesting also is that different people have different preferences for using this type of equipment or not, and different people assign different tasks to using this type of equipment. For example, this is particularly good for answering emails, giving testimony, taking conference calls, and so on. Some of the more creative tasks are better done, some argue, at a regular seated position. And so such tools are most often used in a flexible way. One person, for instance, sharing this type of unit with another individual, and they sort of trade on and off in that regard. And that's also proven to be not only a work-effective model, but also a cost-effective model.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Really, Kenny Geyer? Did you have a question?
Nope.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Thompson?
I would note that if we were to install those in this room,
I would get from 4 to 6 hours of exercise a day while I'm listening to testimony, which is a huge contribution to probably my health and maybe the health of a couple of other people on the committee.
You could just get up and walk around.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. I took it something about 10,000 steps. Is that the recommended? Is there a recommended amount? How much time is this likely to be done by a typical employee?
Is that addressed to the doctor?
Or whoever.
You have to repeat it because the microphone he's listening through is the microphone on the laptop, so he's not hearing us.
Well. Oh, okay. Representative Kenemer asked about the 10,000 steps reference that I had made earlier, and if that is actually the recommended amount. I know it's an American Heart Association recommendation, but and how difficult it would be for someone to accomplish that. How much time on one of your the workstations?
Representative Kinnaman, Chairman Greenlake and the committee, thank you for your question. It raises a number of important points, and I'm going to address them each quite quickly, but we'll provide more detail if you wish. You are correct to say that the 10,000 steps concept is a somewhat American concept, but an excellent one. Of course, using this type of device, this type of approach, assuredly helps an individual complete that goal and actually far exceed it. We have had individuals, for instance, completing, and this is an extreme example, but gives you an idea, 14, that would be 1-4 miles of walking during a work day.
Jeez.
One would have to surmise that it is quite a long work day to achieve that. The second point I'd like to make, and this is important, is I have no conflict of interest. I have no shares or stock in any of the companies that currently make these devices. I did 7 years ago a design contract for 1 year for Steelcase, but that has not been renewed, and I have no money income from that contract. So that's important too. The third point I'd like to make is one that is becoming progressively more important as the scientific evidence mounts, which is that even if one does go to the gym 3 times a day, and if you like, make your 10,000 steps at the gym, the prolonged periods of sedentariness that we experience at work are not offset by those intermediary scattered episodes of gym going. Please do not think I'm saying, however, that gym going is not beneficial. It's terrific and very important for those who can afford to go, both in time and money. However, even going to the gym does not offset prolonged periods of sedentariness. One would argue that this kind of approach does. Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, Dr. Levine, thank you very much for taking time out of your day, although it didn't take time out of your exercise, being with us. And Anthony, thank you for bringing us. We have a couple more witnesses to call.
Sure. Doctor, the chair
before he goes,
wanted to make
Hold on a minute.
No, he can go.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
The chair just wanted me to pass on his thanks and appreciation.
Chair Greenlake and the committee, thank you so much. It is absolutely an honor to speak with you today.
Can I call Elise Brown and Laurel Singer, please?
Bye-bye.
I did. Oh, really?
Thank you.
I know.
Hello. Do you care who starts in which order?
Yes.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlake and Vice Chair Kenny Geyer and Vice Chair Thompson and committee members. My name is Laurel Singer, and I'm here today as a treadmill desk user. And I am not advocating for the bill one way or another. I'm just simply here to tell you about my experience as a treadmill desk user. And let that be information you can use in your decision making. I have had a treadmill. I'm a kind of an early adopter. I've had a treadmill desk for about a year. And I bought it after suffering for about a year and a half with a very severe herniated disc. That I tried everything. I was a really determined to recover. And I had, here's some of the people I saw each week. A chiropractor, a massage therapist. I saw somebody for gentle yoga, a physical therapist, and an acupuncturist. And that was pretty
Holy
much every week.
Sorry. No wonder your back hurts.
I know.
I'm getting pain right now.
I was really quite desperate. And what I found is I had periods of recovery, and then I had some setbacks. So I talked to, and I thought that maybe I had injured it because I was pretty athletic, and what I found was it was due to aging, which was really even more distressing.
It is distressing.
It was very distressing. They said my time had come, and what I started to study was that a lot of these kind of things are not due to any athletic thing other than posture is often at the root of some back problems, and that sitting is really detrimental for back problems. So I was thinking about getting a standing station when my chiropractor mentioned that he'd heard about treadmill desks. So I did some exploring, and there was a range of what you could possibly. The one I got was $1,200. The price has now gone down, I'm sorry to say. But you could pay more if you wanted an electronically raising and lowering desk. I wanted it standard, and I figured $1,200 was sort of a bargain given what I was paying in my treatment providers. And I have to tell you that it was simply amazing. I walk a little slower than the doctor does. I go about a mile an hour, but I get in the morning. I am at an executive level position. I'm at my desk or at meetings 10 hours a day. I'll start my day on the computer, and I'll go and I'll look down and I'll see that I've walked 4 miles. So 4 hours passes quickly, and I then welcome sitting in meetings to take a break. And I got it a year ago in April, and that August I was able to walk without pain across England, which was 172 miles. And I account a lot of it to having built up and healed and recovered by using a treadmill desk. So I would say that it has been an integral part of my recovery, and I have found no decrease in my productivity. It doesn't, in fact, I would say it makes me want to stay at my desk longer. I don't need to get up and take breaks. It's very energizing and stimulating. I will say it's not for everybody. It does take a little bit of adjustment at first to get used to. I think for the first week I had a little bit of seasickness, getting used to moving. But, you know, the concern, I thought I was going to be loud and maybe it would disturb other people. It's very quiet. You cannot hear it. I thought that it would bounce me so I wouldn't be able to work, and it's so slow that it doesn't distract at all from the work that I'm doing. And we've since, I have several people on my staff who've also experienced back problems, and we're looking at trying to revise our work site so that we can have both a standing desk and a moving desk. I have somebody who has epilepsy who couldn't be on a moving desk. So I'm just a big believer. I've since had some colleagues who've been inspired and bought them and have the exact same experience that I do. And log about the same amount of time. 3 to 4 miles is pretty average for me. And I'm planning to walk Mount Blanc this summer. And I have had a steady increase in recovery and no problem at all since I've used this. So I now have free time that I'm not going through treatment providers.
I can tell you that, well, back problems comes at the middle years. If you stick around long enough, your back is so calcified you can't bend over and it stops hurting.
That is sadly good news.
Mr. Kenimer.
I was wondering, as I think about this, I just wonder if there aren't other benefits. Have you seen benefits like in blood pressure or weight or any number of other indices?
You know, I think definitely I'm just less stressed, and uh-huh. I'm actually more focused when I sit down at meetings because I'm ready. I've been stimulated. My brain's stimulated. I'm energized, and so I'm probably more dangerous in my meetings. You know,
or less angry.
Or But I haven't done any research to, you know, really, that wasn't my problem was blood pressure. Yeah. I was really been focused on is my back feeling better, and it has definitely made a huge impact.
How do you figure out how to type while you're walking? It seems to me that would be hard to do.
It doesn't affect me at all. There was no problem with, now if I really have to concentrate on creating a work document, sometimes I'll sit down to do that. But for emails or, you know, when I just the routine kind of communication that we do over email or conference calls, there was absolutely no getting used to it. If I really have to think about a document, I'll sit down.
I was just talking about the physical.
Yeah, it doesn't bounce. It doesn't bounce at all.
Just as a comment on that
we
one.
We do need to move on pretty soon.
I've been working with a jerry-rigged thing, not professional thing at home with a treadmill, and the typing part is very sensitive to the height of the keyboard. There's about a 6-inch zone. If I have the keyboard within that relative to my height standing at the desk, at a raised desk, it works perfectly. But below or above that, it does interfere with typing. So it's a keyboarding angle and height that seems to...
Well, let's move on. Let's ask Elise to... I'm sorry?
That's
right. That's okay. Oh, sorry.
Well, I guess I had a couple of other practical questions. How much additional space is this, and does it create other office inconveniences, and what's been the reception among other coworkers?
Well, so the space issue is I have my own office. It really didn't take up much additional space. If I had to do it again, I would have invested more so that I could have a raising and lowering, and it's really no bigger than this desk here. I mean, this is probably even bigger than my setup. So space is not an issue. I have a place when I have people who come in for meetings that I sit down. I don't really like to be walking. What just doesn't feel right to walk. Why others can't, but yes. You know, but people have been really excited about it, and when I'm not there, they come down and want to use my desk and log on, and that's, other people have bought them in my department so that they can have that as well.
Thank you.
Elise?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Elise Brown on behalf of the American Diabetes Association, and happy to be here, very enthusiastically in support of House Bill 2767, and we just think that this is a real innovative, forward-thinking approach to fighting obesity. As you recall, at the very beginning of this week, we had none other than Scott Brune and his adorable daughter, Katie, all before this panel, talking about the burden of diabetes in Oregon. And just as a quick recap, he told you diabetes is a common disease. 6.3% of Oregonians have diabetes. It's serious. It's caused the death of 1,149 Oregonians, and it's costly. It's costed the state in 2012 over $840 million. So we truly believe that if we're going to make any strides against this devastating disease, we, number one, have to fund the research. And I think this is an interesting way to conduct research through this walking workstation. We have to improve the health care, and we have to support prevention measures. And this is a perfect example of that. So that's why we're very happy to be here today in support of 2767. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah, quick.
I want to thank you both for coming. You both happen to be my constituents. So special welcome. Laurel is also a good friend. I am planning on doing Mont Blanc with her. And I really regret that we're here about 15 hours a day without access to those kind of things. And it would be really interesting to see if in the Capitol we ever got kind of an exercise gym, and maybe we wouldn't be so angry. angry reactions up here. Might help the whole process of governance go better. So thank you both for coming.
You're welcome.
Chairman Widener.
Thank you, Mr.
Last
Chair.
Last question.
Actually, I kind of feel like we're the unhealthy committee when you look at us up here and everybody around the room. But with this, this bill here, are we looking at possibly incentivizing other businesses to get into this? Because I've had this conversation lots of times. I mean, diabetes, like Representative Bruin, is never going to change his situation because he can exercise all he wants. He's five times a day or more. But we have a lot of people on the Oregon Health Plan that we are feeding and contributing to their diabetes because we're giving them an Oregon Trail card and not regulating what they can buy with that. So I think this goes much deeper than what we're doing here, but you have a lot of people in office space where this is our lives right here, and it's how do we change that environment. So, I mean, I'm just kind of curious, are you seeing the results? You don't have diabetes, but if you know anybody who's been overweight that has jumped on one of these and seen a huge change in their life. So, because back pain and diabetes are two different things, but obesity is the number one cause of most of the problems in the U.S.
Mr. Chair, Rep. Widener, I'll attempt to answer that first, and if you have something to add, but I think, you know, putting our money into prevention is the most important thing for us to do, and certainly this is an opportunity to study something at this pilot project. And, you know, the intent for that, as you know, is to see if it works. Let's try it. Let's test it and see what the results are. And I bet, you know, I don't know from personal experience. I lead a very active life myself and appreciate exercise. But, boy, to Rep. Thompson's point, I would love to have some way that we could even testify with a workstation. We'd all be a lot happier. You may want to add anything.
The only thing I would add is this: I could eventually see. I called my health plan to see if they would cover the cost of it because I'm really saving them a ton of money, not going to all these healthcare providers. And I would eventually love to see, you know, the healthcare system support this as a preventative measure, and that may require some evidence to prove its impact.
Well, thank you both very much. I'm going to close the.
While they're changing, I'm worth noting there are presently at least three treadmills on the Senate side in offices, not workstations, but three people with treadmills in their offices. So the possibilities close to home are not that distant.
Well, I do want to comment before I close that. A, I don't think the fiscal is adequate to do what needs to be done, nor do I think if it isn't done carefully we'll find out anything about what happened with 25 people. That's such a small number to get a sense of what goes on, and it's a small number of people who volunteered for it, which makes the characteristics of the people involved in the study a little odd. I mean, we might want to go ahead and do it, but I'm not convinced that we'll really learn anything from it.
It might be the 25 perfectly healthy people that look at, I don't have to waste time going to the gym after work, I can do it while I'm working.
That's right. People who after a few months on it will start walking around mountains. It's probably not going to be several of us on this. I will close the public hearing, and we'll be thinking about this as we go along. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2998, and who do we have to start this off? Why don't you tell us about it first?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2998 prohibits healthcare practitioners from referring patients to healthcare entities which the practitioner has beneficial interest with, for which the practitioner has compensation arrangement. It requires healthcare practitioner making lawful referral to disclose a beneficial interest or compensation arrangement. It requires a healthcare practitioner to disclose the name referring healthcare practitioner on the request for payment or bill submitted to a third-party payer. It makes referring practitioner and healthcare entity jointly and severally liable for any money received after a failure to disclose. It makes failure to disclose interest arrangement in conjunction with lawful referral a misdemeanor. It authorizes the Oregon Health Licensing Agency or Health Professional Regulatory Board to investigate and discipline violations.
And near as I can make out, we don't have anybody testifying in favor of this. Is this right?
Oh, there he is.
Who? Are you testifying in favor of this one?
Right.
Come on. And following that, we'll have David Schlachtis, Gwen Dayton, and Greg Miller as the next panel.
For the record, my name is Chris Altenhoffen. I'm a radiologist working in the Portland area. Thank you, Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee for giving me the opportunity to be here. I've been working as a radiologist in the Portland area for 17 years, and I'm not here sanctioned by my employer, but I will talk about my practice. My practice currently operates three outpatient imaging centers in the Portland area. We're an entirely homegrown operation. Ownership is completely 100% in our state, and we provide 180 quality jobs to the area, many in the economically needy East Portland. We do all of our own billing, IT, and marketing in-house, and all of our radiologists live and work in Oregon, as do most of our employees, with a few living in the Vancouver area. Our centers are full-service centers, and we offer x-ray, ultrasound, mammography, bone density, nuclear medicine, and we don't just focus on the high-end, highly reimbursed CT and MRI examinations. We do have a PET CT scanner also. We also offer pain management and interventional radiology services. We are really a truly unique practice in the state and one that can't be easily replicated or reproduced if we ever go away. We've run a successful outpatient imaging business for over 50 years based on a model of entrepreneurship and innovation. We were the first to bring multi-detector CT and high-field MRI to the outpatient market. We were the first to bring digital mammography and PET imaging to Oregon. Most recently, we brought PEM, or positron emission mammography, and BSGI, coronary artery CT angiography, and cardiac MRI, and virtual colonoscopy to the area. We've been doing virtual colonoscopy for almost 8 years. And we've been doing all of this while maintaining the lowest cost and best customer service in our region. And given a level playing field, we can continue to provide the best and latest innovative technology with the best patient service at the lowest cost. Our 50-year history is our proof of that. And I'd like to contrast this with what is known as self-referral practices. Radiologist-owned businesses such as ours versus clinician-owned imaging services. As radiologists, we are not in place to order advanced imaging exams on our patients, but we require referrals from physicians to maintain our practice. This is in distinction to practices owned by clinicians that install their own imaging equipment in their practices and then order, perform, and bill for these examinations within their own practice. This creates a classic conflict of interest, pitting physician financial self-interest against the true needs and best interests of the patients. Radiologist-owned practices do not do this. In essence, this arrangement is anti-competitive and it distorts the imaging marketplace. Self-referring physicians are able to set up their own high-end imaging business, order, perform, and bill for exams, and drive their own demand to their business, guaranteeing their own financial success while being shielded from the risks of competing in the broader marketplace that requires competition for referrals. It creates what I call a market haven, H-A-V-N, as in safe haven, protected from the realities of the broader marketplace. It essentially carves out patients from the imaging market, and it at times denies those patients referrals to better and lower cost imaging services. No matter what we do in our practice in terms of innovation, service, or pricing, we are denied access to those patients. Another consequence of this lack of competition is diminished quality of examinations. Because of the haven nature of these arrangements, these groups do not need to purchase the best or most innovative imaging equipment because they are not competing. Right now in the Portland area, there are self-referring groups utilizing substandard imaging equipment, but maintaining their volumes for self-referral and billing and collecting for these services. Ironically, we've seen recent reimbursement cuts targeted at our practice by BCBS. They cut our reimbursement rates by 29%. We now make about 20% less than these same type of self-referring practices in the outpatient market. Sometimes it's just the world seems upside down, where we can provide better quality imaging, better service to our patients, and we still get paid substantially less. We get paid probably 40% less than the same services provided in the hospitals. All of this inhibits entrepreneurship and innovation in the imaging marketplace. Our historically innovative group is no longer eager to invest in new technologies, technologies that bring real benefits to the patients, as we can attract the referrals needed to support these investments. We are right now delaying purchases of new CT scanners, such as dual-energy CT scanners with iterative reconstruction technology that lowers patient radiation dose. New breast imaging technologies such as tomosynthesis we're delaying until we have greater clarity on where the healthcare market's going. So I would like to touch on two additional very important consequences of self-referral beyond the market aspects.
Briefly, please.
Overutilization of advanced imaging, contributing to escalating healthcare expenditures. There has been several studies that document the extent to which self-referral induces overutilization, with these studies showing increased rates from 54 to 700%. That 700% number is an anecdotal practice in the Midwest, a urology practice that when they bought their CT scanner, their use of CT went up by 700%. I did provide you with a cover summary sheet on a recent GAO study from September 2012. Don't know if you have those available, but I have copies. If you look at that, there's a small table at the bottom. And they did a study from 2008 to 2010, and it looked at practices where they did not self-refer. It looked at patients or practices that self-referred over those that time frame, and then they looked at practices that switched from non-self-referring or from non-self-referring to self-referring. And you can see that self-referrers had a much higher utilization rate than the non-self-referrers, twice as much. The people who switched, their utilization rate went up 67% from when they went from a non-self-referring practice to a self-referring practice. Other studies have documented similar increases, and the estimated cost to CMS and Medicare has been placed conservatively in the hundreds of millions of dollars. The conclusion of that report said, to the extent that these referrals are unnecessary, they pose an unacceptable risk for beneficiaries, particularly in the case of CT services, which involves the use of ionizing radiation. A 2011 meta-analysis estimated the cost to be $3.6 billion in extra costs, not just to Medicare, but to the broader healthcare market. And in these days of high insurance deductibles, where they can be as high as $3,500, a lot of these financial costs are borne directly by the patient as out-of-pocket expenses. There are real patient safety issues associated with this, given the unnecessary exposure to ionizing radiation from CT scans. It's actually a major public health issue, and I would appeal to you, with your sense of responsibility as public stewards, to respond in some measure to protect patients from unnecessary risk. And I would hope that if you don't take away any other point from today, that you remember that we are dealing here with a real patient safety issue. Other effects of self-referral, incidental findings.
Wrap it up, please.
That require biopsy, sometimes invasive procedures. And I'll make a few more comments here then.
Very few more. Please
okay.
Wrap it up.
Yeah. All right. Well, I just will touch on the bill then, real quick. It addresses advanced imaging, CT and MRI, and PET CT. It does not restrict physician offices from offering the more common and low-cost X-ray, mammography, or ultrasound services. It also doesn't prevent physicians from investing in other outpatient imaging centers if they feel that that is a good investment. But it does sensibly prevent them from referring patients to those centers and inappropriately driving their own demand, which we know increases utilization rates considerably. So when considering these issues, I would hope you would keep in mind that in addition to the cost to society on a broader scale of ever-increasing healthcare expenditures, you keep in mind the interests of the individual patients, particularly the idea of unnecessary radiation exposure, as well as undue financial burden as they pay out-of-pocket for these tests.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Just a comment. Thank you for the data. I think it's self.
It's in OLIS, by the way.
Yeah, I've got it.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah, that is.
Well, it's actually a big issue. Mm-hmm. You know, it is being addressed on the federal level, mm-hmm. ineffectively. And I would also add that most states have some form of self-referral law on the books. I sent you a table that outlined state by state which states do and which states don't. Oregon is one of
very
the few states that has none.
Thank you. Can I have the next panel, please, that I announce? And I'll ask you all to be as brief as you can, please. Any order.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing us to testify today. My name is David Schlachtis. I am the CEO of Hope Orthopedics of Oregon, 17 physician group here in Salem, and I'm also speaking on behalf of the Oregon Association of Orthopedic Surgeons. Yes, we wanted to touch on House Bill 2998, specifically the sections that the prior speaker was talking about. I think he's forgetting some very key and very important points that are germane to especially the state of Oregon. The first off is insurance oversight. Insurance companies choose who they will contract with, so they do or do not have to contract with anyone if they feel that you're overutilizing. They always have that opportunity to decide that we think that your practice is overutilizing, so we won't contract with you. But more importantly, the whole issue of overutilization. The vast majority of commercial insurance companies, Regions, LifeWise, ODS, Providence, they all require prior authorization to get advanced imaging. We don't have CT, we have MRI. Every single one of ours has to go through prior authorization. So we send our documentation, we send our notes, we send our request for authorization to the insurance companies. And the insurance companies say, yes, that's appropriate, go ahead and take the MRI, or no, it's not appropriate. So that is your guarantee that in this state, the insurance companies are the watchdog to prevent overutilization in situations, at least with orthopedic surgeons.
How often they tell you no?
Excuse me?
How often do they tell you no?
I'd have to go back and get the statistics, Chair Greenlick, but I suspect not very often because we use it very selectively. In fact, in our situation, once we put it in, our utilization actually went down. We were so cautious and nervous about overutilization that we ended up doing less MRIs than we had previously done before we had our own MRI machine. And to this day, we still do less than we had done before. So we're orthopedic surgeons. Our surgeons order it to confirm the need for surgery. So that's why we don't get very many no's. They're not using it just to see whether or not you twisted an ankle. They're saying, okay, I'm pretty sure you tore your meniscus. Let me see whether or not there actually is a tear in that meniscus, which would then justify surgery. One of the other things that is important for all of you to know is that the prevalence of these machines are under federal Stark law. It's called the in-office ancillary services exemption. And as part of that, we are required by federal law to provide a brochure to all of our patients that get an MRI that clearly states, here are your other alternatives. This is about patient choice. The speaker before us was talking in such a way that it would actually decrease patient choice. It would eliminate all the choices for the patients. We actually provide a brochure that on the back of it lists 8 other alternatives for our patients. They don't have to get an MRI in our facility. They've got all sorts of alternatives. They can go to any other one that they want within a 25-mile radius. If they choose to come to us, great, but it is not required by law, and we cannot write a referral that says, this referral is good for one MRI, but only at our facility. It's a general referral that says you need an MRI, and here's your choices as to where you're going to get your MRI. Finally, I guess the last comment, because I know that we're under a time crunch, I would like to say that all of you have taken a broad step, an important step, to controlling costs in healthcare in the state of Oregon, and that is you've created CCOs. Now within CCOs, we know that all the money for the Oregon Health Plan patients are going to the communities for them to control. There's a very strong likelihood that within the next 2 years, the PEB and the OEB patients, or a good portion of them, will go into the CCOs. I would encourage you strongly not to pass either this bill or at least this portion of the bill. Give the CCOs the responsibility that you've already designated to them, the opportunity to decide for themselves in each local community, what do we want to do? How do we want to control the costs in our community? How do we want to allocate those resources? This bill, and especially this portion of the bill, would take that out of the hands of the CCOs, which would be a big step towards their inability to do what you've charged them with doing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm Gwen Dayton, General Counsel for the Oregon Medical Association, Chair Greenlick, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I won't, you have my written testimony, and some of it was just covered, so I won't repeat that, but to emphasize just a few points. First, we are just getting going with CCOs, and they rely so heavily on integration of care, coordination of care amongst providers under a discrete global budget. It is now the time that we want to adopt an Oregon law that would further restrict referrals amongst providers, as we are just trying to enact a system that relies heavily on those referrals. And I know when I was thinking about this bill, actually, I was looking back, and actually House Bill 3650, which was passed in 2011, actually directs the state to look at whether we would even need a stark waiver for the CCOs. And so do we really, at a time when we're wondering if we need a waiver from the federal stark law, think about adopting an Oregon stark law? Perhaps the better course, as we all care about this issue. We all care about overutilization. It's critical to control it if we're going to be successful in the efficiencies that we must obtain. Shouldn't we be looking to the CCOs under that discrete global budget to manage that issue rather than try to adopt another law that parallels the federal law? And related to that, as a lawyer, I looked at this and I thought this is kind of a Full Employment for Lawyers Act in a way, because you've got a really complex stark law that's been around for a while, and they revise it every so often. It's the kind of thing that lawyers specialize in. It's very complex. Do we want to adopt an Oregon law that tries to somewhat parallel it but doesn't? There's inconsistencies between this law and the federal law. So you're creating...
I mean, the Oregon Bar is supporting this on the basis...
Pardon? The Oregon State Bar, I don't believe... I certainly do not speak for them. I don't know. But it would be the kind of law that would require a lot of compliance... compliance work by providers and others, because there are differences between this law that you're considering today and the Stark law. And so as we're trying to comply with both, it's just challenging. And inevitably, Stark will change again, and we'll have to try to keep up. And you just create a nightmare of compliance between federal and state law. And that would be fine if we felt that it was the only way to serve a good that we needed to achieve. But the OMA is not certain if this bill really achieves that good. And so we would urge you to take a step back, watch how the CCOs do with this. Watch the new, as Mr. Slack just referenced, the Accountable Care Act requirement that went into effect in 2011 that requires, if you're referring to an MRI or CT scan in your office, that you notify the patient of your interest and notify them of other options. That's a relatively recent law as well. Let's see how these things work before we start adopting a law that's just going to make life pretty complicated. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Greg Miller. I'm representing the Oregon Urology Institute. The Oregon Urology Institute has offices in Springfield, Roseburg, and Florence, Oregon, and they're widely regarded as the experts in urology in the Northwest. They provide state-of-the-art services using the Da Vinci robotics in their surgical surgery, specialized physical therapy, imaging, pathology, full-service urology needs. As my colleague have suggested, are concerned about this bill and what it does for the coordination of care for our patients. I'd like to give you an example of how the specified care that Oregon Urology provides to its patients is beneficial to the patient community. Terry Fitzpatrick, who is the administrator of the facility, had a friend. His wife was advised by her primary care doctor that she was going to need surgery for a urology issue. Mr. Fitzpatrick advised and requested maybe that she come in and see the physical therapist that works at Oregon Urology and maybe avoid having to go under the knife. After a consultation at Oregon Urology and a couple of visits to PT, this woman was feeling better about her issue and did not have to go under surgery. So you can see that specialized care that you receive at centers like Oregon Urology have definite benefits to the patients that come there. Allowing the center like Oregon Urology to coordinate their care keeps folks out of the emergency room as they, you know, wait to go see other imaging centers or get other care. And we do follow the same requirements under the Stark Law and under Oregon Rule that do require disclosure to patients about financial interest, other options, et cetera. So if you have any answering questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.
Can I slip a quick question in,
sure.
Mr. Chair? I'm just curious. I actually have two, but I think they're both quick and fairly easy. One is, do you think that the defensive medicine, rather than the opportunity to profit, might explain more instances of overutilization? And the second question is, does anybody have a sense of, and I'm talking broad terms here, I'm not asking for anybody's proprietary information about their particular practice, but in general, what's the percentage of a typical surgery practice net income that's attributable to a device like an MRI versus the practice of medicine?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Conger, specifically with regard to defensive medicine, I have to guess at this point. I think that yes, there is a certain amount of it, but I, at least in the practice of orthopedics, it's fairly low. And the reason why is, if you think about it, you come in and we think you have a torn meniscus, but we're not entirely sure. So what is the safer thing to do for the patient? Go get an MRI or go immediately to surgery and put them under anesthesia and put them under the knife. It is far cheaper. It's probably 10 times less expensive. It's probably 10% of the cost of the surgery and all of the costs associated with surgery to go get an MRI to confirm that, yes, you do need surgery, because there's a certain percentage of the time that, wow, the MRI showed that, no, you don't need surgery. Actually, that exact same thing happened to me where I had a knee injury. They did the MRI, and they found out that there was no tear, so I didn't need surgery. Saved me all of the costs and all of the issues associated with surgery. So there might be a little bit of defensive medicine, but at least in orthopedics, it's really to confirm, do you need surgery? Surgery is a last resort. It is not the first choice.
Go next.
The second thing is what percent cost of in terms of the revenue. In our practice, it's less than 5% of our total net income.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2998 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3163. And we have Lynn Marie Kreider and Sandra Powell, please. Can you tell us what this is about while we're coming in?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3163 requires a health care facility that contracts with or is represented on the board of directors of a coordinated care organization to offer a group health insurance plan for full and part-time employees. It requires a collective bargaining agreement between the facility and employees to approve the group health plan. It requires that employee contribution toward premium costs not exceed 8% of household income in 2014 and pegs future contribution to rate of premium and income growth.
Yeah, it's not just
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Lynn Marie Kreider, bargaining coordinator for Service Employees International Union Local 49, a union representing 10,000 private sector workers in health care, property services, and other industries. I want to ask you to put aside the bill and the -1 amendments, which perhaps was what was just described to you. They are flawed. We wouldn't ask you to send them out. I wasn't personally involved in developing this, but I've been asked to share with you the concerns that led to the effort to bring this bill to you. So, in other words, I think we need more work, but I'd like to have the opportunity for myself and Sandra Powell, who is an employee at Good Samaritan Hospital in Portland, to just describe for you the affordability issues facing healthcare workers in the state. The Affordable Care Act is expected to increase the numbers of non-elderly Oregonians with insurance coverage by nearly 200,000 people from 2013 to 2014. When people have insurance, they use more services and providers are paid more for them. So healthcare employers will benefit from millions, if not billions, in new federal, state, employer, and individual dollars moving into the system. As beneficiaries of expanded coverage, healthcare employers should be held to a higher standard than other employers. They should provide coverage for their employees and their families that is affordable premiums and uses a benefit structure that encourages timely access to care. Unfortunately, the reality is that rather than making healthcare coverage more affordable for workers, many hospitals and other healthcare facilities at this time are moving more of the cost of healthcare to their employees using high deductible plan structures that, in fact, both make it difficult for low-wage workers to access coverage at all for their families, and also mean that even if they have coverage, they're afraid to go to the doctor because they don't know how much it's going to cost when they go. They may see a $400 bill. They're going to have to pay it out of pocket, and they don't have that $400. So there's a problem. Basically, the ACA really is expecting all citizens under Medicare age to get coverage. And they have three basic avenues, as you know, for getting that. One is through an expanded Medicaid program, which is our CCO program here in Oregon, through employer-sponsored plans for employees and their families, or through the exchanges, which, thanks to federal subsidies, will provide reduced price coverage with lower than typical cost sharing on a sliding fee scale. But to keep the cost of the program down, Congress designed the exchange subsidy program so it is not available to the families of workers whose employers offer coverage. So a key component of the plan is that employers will offer coverage, but sometimes that coverage is not affordable, and that's what we're seeing. Many employers, even healthcare employers, pay a healthy share of the premium for their own workers, but little or nothing toward the coverage for their spouses and children. For example, a small healthcare provider that I've been bargaining with recently on behalf of SEIU provides for full-time employees, it provides 100% coverage for the employee himself. But for the kids, nothing. They can buy it if they can afford it. But a lot of these workers can't afford to buy that coverage for themselves their kids or for a spouse. And unfortunately, these plans that we're seeing in hospitals are becoming less and less affordable. For example, Mackenzie Willamette Hospital, a for-profit hospital that earned an operating profit of over 18% in 2011. That's about five times the operating profit of the average Oregon hospital, has been proposing in each of the last couple of years to increase premiums for workers and their families. At the same time it was proposing to increase premiums, the hospital also proposed to increase deductibles and copays. Our union successfully resisted those increases, but non-union workers are paying those higher premiums and higher cost sharing. There is also a trend in the major health system, St. Charles Hospital in Bend, Peace Health Hospital, or Sacred Heart in Eugene, Samaritan Health System, all are moving toward high deductible plans with health savings accounts. And they pitch those as something that's good for employees because they can save pre-tax dollars and so forth to use for health care. But for low-wage workers that we represent, it means that a huge percentage of their income potentially goes for health insurance. Let me use an example. An entry-level worker.
Can I ask you, how long do you expect your testimony?
I expect that my testimony is another maybe three or four minutes. Then Ms. Powell will speak. And we had hoped to have some additional workers. They were not able to attend, so you have a DVD of their stories.
Okay, go on.
Let's look at, for example, an entry-level CNA at Good Samaritan Regional Medical Center in Corvallis. The standard schedule for those workers is 36-hour week. They gross less than $2,000 a month. If that CNA is married and has two kids, say your husband makes the same amount of money, a couple thousand a month, but doesn't have health coverage through their employer, that family will have too high an income for Medicaid, even after the 2014 expansion. Her husband and kids won't be able to get federal assistance to purchase on the exchange because they have access to that Samaritan plan. But the problem is that that CNA will have to pay 15% of her $2,000 a month to buy coverage under a PPO plan. If that's too much, she can pay 10% of her gross for a high deductible plan, but that means she's exposed to potentially spending 30% of her gross income for health care before the plan starts paying. That's not affordable coverage. It's not the kind of coverage that I think we're trying to get through the other programs that are part of the ACA umbrella. So there's a disconnect between the money that we're pouring into the healthcare system and the kinds of plans that they're offering to their own employees. And the concept that we want you to think about is the notion that Oregon needs to challenge healthcare facilities that participate in healthcare transformation in this state by contracting with CCOs or as direct Medicaid providers to provide affordable coverage for their workers under plan designs that don't create barriers to access, but rather encourage preventive and chronic care. So we plan to work to try to define more clearly the affordability standards we'd like you to adopt. Thank you.
Ms. Hunter?
Sandra?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of committee. My name is Sandra Powell, and I work at the Good Samaritan Hospital in Portland, Oregon. I have been in dietary services for 15 years. I come before you today to discuss an issue that means a great deal to me and my coworkers at Good Samaritan Hospital. Many, many community members, including my own family and friends, assumed that when I was employed at Good Samaritan Hospital, that I would have excellent health care coverage. Sadly, this is not true. Through our union, we have been able to reduce some of our cost of health care by negotiating with Legacy. But the remaining cost is still very, very high. As a dietary employee, my pay is low, making it difficult to afford such things as co-pays, prescriptions, etc. Recently, I experienced a life-threatening situation. I thought I was having a heart attack. I was having chest pain. And as I sat in my room, in my bedroom, in my bed, I sat there for 2 or 3 hours deciding if I should go to the emergency room or what should I do, because I know that I can't really afford to go to the ER. So I called my sister, and she said to me, maybe it's gas. And I'm thinking, it doesn't feel like gas. The pain is getting worse and worse. I need to hurry up and get to a doctor, to the hospital. I feel like I'm going to die. So she's like, okay, I'll be there. And the way I was feeling, I should have called 911, but I didn't call 911 because I can't afford an ambulance. My insurance doesn't cover an ambulance cost, so I'm thinking, I can't afford that. So my sister, a couple of miles away, rushed to my house and took me to the hospital. And on the way, she was very frightened because I kept telling her, I'm going to die. I felt like I was going to die. So when I got there, of course, they asked me for my copay, which I didn't have. So they didn't worry about the copay because I ended up getting admitted into the hospital. And I stayed overnight with observations and all these tests that they had to take, you know, making sure it wasn't a heart attack. So saying that, I'm kind of afraid in the next couple of weeks to check the mailbox to see these bills, because I know I can't afford them, because it's going to be thousands and thousands of dollars for all these tests that they had to take regarding my chest pain. So every day I work hard to take care of patients in Legacy Good Samaritan Hospital and to help make profit for Legacy. All that I am asking on behalf of myself and my coworkers is that we have access to affordable health care and that we can use the services that we help provide to patients when we need them. Thank you for your time and today. Thank you for your time today and listening to my story. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Glad you're doing better.
I think you were lucky not calling an ambulance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was.
Mm-hmm. Very good story. It's very important. We'll be working on it.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Did you go to Legacy for that?
I did. The hospital where I work.
Can I just say one thing?
Yeah. Go ahead. Take up your time.
Avoiding you, maybe. I just wanted to say that this is an important question for all low-income workers. It does seem particularly important in the healthcare industry, not only because of the irony of giving other people healthcare, but when you think about the public health aspect of having people not have proper health care, particularly if they're driven toward the high deductible plans, not doing the preventative kind of measures, and then exposing patients to that. So that piece of it, too.
I'm an irony guy, too. But yeah. The irony of it just seems amazing. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3163 and open up a work session on House Bill 2997. Ask Colleen Mercer to come up here, not to give testimony, but to be available to answer questions. And
Mark Mayer is the LC if you want him to speak.
Mark, you want to join us as well? Let me just say what I hope we can get out of this. We've got about 35 minutes to have a conversation about this bill. We want to pass this bill. It's an important bill. But what we want to do is look at, I can ask Representative Kenny Geyer to lead us through the issues that are facing us. And what I'd like to get is some sense of how we would like to go with amendments on any of the issues that are before us. So it's a chance for us to talk to each other about this. We're not taking any testimony, but we can ask Mark or Holly anything we need, and let's go.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, colleagues. As you know, this has been a tough issue. I'm going to mention a couple of issues quickly because I think they deserve mentioning, but I think that we've made a lot of progress, probably have some amendments coming, and I don't see them as sticking points. But if you have heard from people or in your own mind you have questions about it, then this is a good time before we send things back to Mark as our LC drafter and burden him with doing it over and over again. It's a kind of good check-in point. So I'm going to go over a couple of small things, but then I'm going to really focus mostly on the exemption issue because that's the one that is probably causing the most heartburn for everyone. So we just have an opportunity to say, do we want to see a couple different amendments from Mark and come back, or can we get some kind of clarity around it? some of this is, you know, I want to see where everyone is. People in the audience may want to hear, or may want to give some feedback before we take any particular action on this issue. Thank you. So the couple of small things around OMA had suggested an amendment around taking, I think it's called tocolactics, out. I think everyone's in agreement that we decided that's fine. There's a piece of governance that Holly can address later. You can ask more questions about. In terms of, at one point, we thought that there should be a new fund within the Treasury that would be the Direct Entry Midwifery Fund, and that because we were giving more authority to the Direct Entry Midwifery Board, they would handle some of their own finances in a reimbursement with OLA. That looks like it's not very doable and is really not necessary. And so, again, if there's questions about this, ask Holly. But I think there's been, I think that Silke Akerson from the Oregon Midwifery Council is comfortable with the funds flowing as they've always flowed. There is another issue around final authority or independent authority that is in this bill. What we are asking for in this bill is to give the Direct Entry Midwifery Board final authority over both investigations and rulemaking. This is different than the board has had before. OLA had the final authority. This was something that our work group discussed a lot. We decided, I wouldn't say it was complete consensus on it, but more people were in favor of it, and people were willing to give that a try as something of saying that midwives know this profession, and we want to give them both the authority but also the responsibility to really handle this profession. Holly had pointed out that it's unusual that you would have the final authority over rulemaking and investigations, but not licensing, actually doing the licensing. And so that might be a change that we might make. I don't think that there's heartburn around those kind of issues. Holly has just come from overseeing the Board of Nursing and so has a good sense of what the norm is out there. So that's likely amendment we would do. If there are any strong feelings on that, we'd love to know. The exemption piece is the biggest piece. And the way it is framed right now in the bill is that licensing is mandatory, but that we would allow exemptions for people for cultural, religious reasons. That is very broadly defined right now, and the intent of that was not to give the DEM board, at least my intent, and because it's not clear in the bill, it needs to be clarified. I'll tell you what my intent is, and then we need to talk about what the intent should be and how that gets reflected in language. My intent was that we were not putting the board in the position of deciding when people, you know, ask for an exemption. We're not putting them in the position of saying, well, yeah, we think that you qualify for a cultural or religious exemption and you don't. The idea was that we were going to try really hard to get everyone to volunteer, well, to become licensed by having a governance structure that is more in line with what the midwives have really wanted and one of the barriers for them to licensing, and also working on the financial issue. The fees are really high. So we want as many people, I think there are about 40 direct entry midwives who are not licensed right now, not chosen to be licensed. We're going to try to do as many things to remove the barriers and encourage them to get licensed. Those that choose still not to get licensed, the idea was not that to put them in a decision-making, which Holly can talk about how she would carry that out or feel about carrying that out, but that for those folks, and we don't know how many out of those folks it would be. We would hope it would be a very small group, but for those, they would have to give informed consent letters to their patients saying, making it very clear that they're not licensed, that no one is regulating them, that there's not recourse, that there's no one checking of what the minimum level of training, experience, and education is. And so we were trying to keep open the option that for people who want to choose that kind of midwife, but with some very strong informed consent. So that is the situation that we have right now. There, you have probably heard, I know some of you have gotten letters, that there are those who feel like, well, then it's not really mandatory licensing. So some of the other ideas that have been on the table that Representative Parrish and I did not put in the bill, but we want to give, you know, fair exposure to those ideas. One idea was if you choose to not be licensed, then you cannot call yourself a direct entry midwife. You could call yourself something else, and there's a big question about whether you can use the term midwife at all, traditional midwife, granny midwife, any kind of midwife, or does it have to be something that's not doesn't use the term midwife at all? There's a lot of very strong feelings around this. You know, can you do you say birth attendant or traditional birth attendant? So part of not going that direction was feeling like this is a very contentious issue, and we wanted to get this bill as far as we could without getting really tripped up in the things that are hard for people. And part of that is just recognizing that the term midwife it has a huge cultural tradition over many, many decades and centuries, and that there may be, for instance, the Somali grandmother who's been practicing and had 1,000 births, and we're taking away a term of honor. And so it was just kind of, you know, the angst around that. The other part for me, and I think that since it's been questioned a lot more in the last couple of weeks, that I feel like I need more clarity maybe from Mark or DOJ, is that my assumption was that if we had unlicensed direct entry midwives, it kind of gave the board of direct entry midwifery more of this authority to do what we say in the bill, which is, you know, that you have to have an exemption, and that if you aren't giving out the informed consent, that you're subject to the civil penalties. Again, that was my intent, and I'm not sure if the as written it clarifies that. But if we call them something other than direct entry midwives, does the Board of Direct Entry Midwifery really have the ability to do this informed consent over traditional birth attendants, or are we going to lose that piece? If there's no body that's you know making sure that that happens, are we going to lose that piece, which I thought was a really strong part of the bill, the informed consent for people was in, and we haven't figured out how we would do that piece if people were not called direct entry midwives. And then another piece of this, I'm going to throw out all the ideas so you can respond and ask questions. Another thing that we've discussed is, aside from the name, if we went ahead without the name and kept it as in the bill right now, putting a sunset, another idea is to put a sunset on both the exemption piece and the final authority piece, since these are the pieces that people have a lot of questions about, allowing it to go ahead, allowing to try it and see what happens. The idea of having a sunset is just that it closes it off and forces us to take action and say, you know, now that we have this data about how it's working and how many people have gotten exempt, do we want to continue?
But actually, won't force us to take action.
If it
sunsets, it sunsets, and then we're back where we are now.
Okay, so the other idea was like a trigger. If more than 5% choose the exemption and don't come, you know, that, you know, what would we do about that? So those are some of the, we've never really been able to come to a consensus on the exemption piece. And so Representative Parrish and I put this one forward as the one that we felt moved the farthest along without losing a lot of people. And you could push farther, but you might lose a lot more people.
To start the discussion, let me say that I think our two colleagues worked remarkably well to move this process through that very complex situation. Where we are now is it's not an issue of getting consensus outside the building. It's an issue of getting consensus inside the building. So it's now our job, and maybe it isn't even a matter of getting consensus. It's a matter of how do we get to 31, 16, and 1, which is easy, and I mean, it's hard enough to do without worrying about consensus. I think we're open, and I'll be happy to. I think the only critical issue in this discussion is the question of mandatory licensing, which is the underlying basis. And it seems to me, this is from perspective of one vote, because I will say I'll pass anything out here that has 5 votes, regardless of what my vote is in this case. So this is, I think this is going to be our bill going forward and not one of our bills or the other. For my one vote, I think all midwives should be licensed. And I think it would be fine if people want to call themselves whatever they want to call themselves. Incidentally, I don't think the Somalian grandmother has been calling themselves midwives for 1,000 years. That's an English term. If there's a Somalian term that would cover what that person does, I would say that's what that person ought to use. But I just think we have to, I think these are healthcare providers. birth is a perfectly normal, natural, simple thing until it's not. And then it becomes a life-saving issue of what's going on.
I am cautious and flexible on this. I think one of my concerns is that we are reaching into a deeply cultural situation where there aren't any real absolutes. And as an example of that, I think if we pass the most stringent bill we possibly can, and then we put the death penalty on anyone who doesn't adhere to it, it still is not going to keep a mother from either giving birth alone or giving birth with a neighbor attending or the cable repair guy or whatever. We're going to have a birth. And I think if we get too wound up in the technical language of who is in and who is out, we're just simply setting ourselves up for someone to declare themselves a religious birth attendant, but not a midwife, and they're going to proceed on anyway. So I'm willing to accept the best we can get at this point with the understanding, whatever that it turns out to be, or the committee, with the understanding that I have not seen a statute passed out of here yet that we couldn't come back and tinker with next year or in 2 years if something came up from Holly or somebody else who said, whoa, here, we got a piece of this that's really not working, you know, or we've got 240 people who have declared themselves Somali midwives and whatever that word is, but it's not English, and now we have a whole new industry blooming that we have to control. So I would think let's do what we can do and not get too locked down on perfection at this point.
Representative Thompson, I want to go on the record to point out I'm opposed to the death penalty.
Perhaps I might rethink that.
Could I say something? It's funny because I've worked on this for so many months and it all of a sudden struck me right now that maybe we just need to get rid of the word exemption. What we're talking about is mandatory licensing of direct entry midwives. And the other question is, for those that do not get licensed, what do we do with that population?
Yes, right.
There is the possibility, as some states have done, with some, I think, arguably some pretty bad results of criminalizing it, saying, okay, you cannot do this at all, or you can't do it and receive a fee. And so I think that I just realized, why am I saying exemption at all? Forget that. I mean, maybe that would clear up the thing about you have to decide who's exempt or not. We have mandatory licensing. What do you do to enable people to still have the choice to deliver outside of that system, which there's a very strong component of our society that wants that choice, and so providers want to be able to offer it, and consumers want to be able to have it, and I frankly want to be able to honor that, but with some very strong informed, and I keep trying to figure out how does that happen in relation to this bill and the direct entry midwifery license.
It is common for a profession or an occupation to protect its name. I mean, massage therapy is a perfect example of that. Mm-hmm. Where, you can do anything. Well, that may be a bad example, but there are some where you can do counseling. You just can't call yourself a counselor or a psychologist.
Oh, the title act.
Yeah.
So you can do a title act, and that protects the title. Mm-hmm. And I like that notion. I think a title act says, if this is what midwifery, is, and you cannot call yourself such unless you are licensed. That would be an example of one way to frame a practice act, a title act. I think the other is it needs to be added. I think it needs to be both practice and title. Practice is then what do midwives do?
Right.
And I think you balance that by having both of those there. And then after that, I don't know, I like not having many exemptions. I think there are perhaps extraordinary cases. But I think our idea is that we think, at least I am of the belief, that there are concerns for safety. And those, I don't know how you address that perfectly. I think you endeavor to have people licensed, mm-hmm. and if they want to call themselves a midwife, they must be licensed.
Yeah.
So just
after I'm Congress, I think I'm next. I'll
yeah,
try and keep some.
Okay, yeah. You
do. Want everybody to have a chance to talk.
I guess I would hesitate to protect a title for an industry. You know, there are laws to do that on your own, you know, trademarking and patenting and things. I think
attorney is
and you got to keep these attorneys in business.
Yeah, right?
But I think, you know, from where I'm sitting, my interest in this has more to do with where consumers of this service, mothers, have a perception that because the title is there, that it implies some level of expertise or training or something beyond it's just your neighbor and they're telling you they can help you birth your baby. And if that exists, I mean, if there is this perception that there is this, you know, a level of expertise, then I think you are protecting the consumers by establishing standards for using that professional title. And in this case, you know, direct entry midwife, you know, call it what you will. I think that's very important because the alternative is that perception is allowed to exist. There are no standards, and therefore you can have people who really don't have the expertise who just call themselves that and then end up causing harm. I think Representative Kenny Geyer's point, which was one of the points on this bill, had to do with the exemption. I agree with your last statement. If there is a profession to be created here and standards to be established in order to be able to be licensed in that profession, meaning the state is now saying that these people have met this qualification, then it's not an exemption. There's the professional title and the license, and then there's everybody else. And if a person says, well, there's a profession of midwifery and I can have a midwife come to my home and you know, walk me through birth, but I don't need a midwife. I'm okay with you know, my neighbor or my aunt or whoever. That's their choice. And I'm not sure that informed consent is necessary beyond that. Because, I make stupid decisions all the time. Mm-hmm. I know none of you look shocked. I appreciate that.
Sorry. We're just wondering whether to admit we did too. Decided not to.
Yeah. And you know, there's only so much that the state can protect me from that. But you can identify a practice, you can identify a profession, and create those standards to give consumers that level of confidence and be able to rely on that.
I think
Congress just basically said what I was saying. The line is what the person is or is not licensed to do. I don't think we can prevent the neighbor from assisting and performing duties of a midwife. And if we go beyond this licensing point, then we have to say, okay, we're going to criminalize everybody on that other side. We're really not going to do that because that's really, at least not right now, unless somebody comes up with a new name and starts a new profession outside the law, which does substantially the same thing. So if we can get everybody who is professionally calling themselves midwives to interacting as a profession without exception, I think that's really great. Then we can come back 2, 3, 5 years and say, okay, we got this whole bunch of people out here that are still doing midwifery under some other name. We've got to do something about them too. That's another issue.
We're not.
But
we'll do something. We're not doing something.
Yeah. May I just say something quickly to correct myself? I analogized stupid decisions, and I think by implication, and I suggested that having a baby at home without a midwife or a doctor or whatever, that's a personal decision. And so I don't want to imply that someone's choice to do that is good, bad, or indifferent. That wasn't hopefully what that sounded like. I just meant license the profession. If someone chooses not to use a licensed professional, then that's their choice.
I didn't hear it that way.
Thank you.
So I think that the gray area for me, if you choose to, you know, have your sister deliver your baby or a neighbor, that's one thing. You choose a licensed direct entry midwife, that's another thing. I think the gray area is the people who want to practice this profession who are not licensed, who, you know, do we call, okay, I'm very comfortable not calling them direct entry midwife. But if you use the term midwife at all, you know, a traditional midwife, a granny midwife, a lay midwife, any other, you know, can they use that term at all? That is a question. But I think maybe we should just kind of open it up to how, for Holly, how that might run. Just reactions.
Yes. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I sent an email that kind of bulleted some of my concerns, particularly on the fiscal side, but I think that we've ironed that out. This board has been operating in the red for quite some time. I had extreme concerns about creating additional lawsuits, particularly around the definition of an exemption. So don't know if that was put back on the board or the agency to make that decision. I can very, very much predict that we would get contested cases if we were the ones that said, no, you are exempt or no, you aren't. So if that exemption piece goes away, or we just decide as a policy that everyone who doesn't license is exempt, and it's not up to the board or the agency to make that decision, that's very helpful.
That would certainly not be anything that I would accept. I mean, it seems to me, I think we were talking about, anybody who's a midwife is a midwife, and they need license. In the next 5 years to get licensed. If they're not licensed, then they're not a midwife, and they can't refer themselves to midwife.
You don't want to see the term midwife in there at all?
I think traditional
midwife.
Yeah.
No, I only want to see people who are midwives who are licensed.
So
as midwife, I mean, this is my slogan. And it's only, I'm going to suggest we get a few amendments and we could actually vote on them and see what we want. But my suggestion is they're midwives or they're not midwives. If they're midwives, they're licensed. If they do something else around births, go for it.
And Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I think that's where the board and the agency would want some kind of guidance, and maybe it's just going to be through cases, that if we investigate a case, if we get a complaint that says that this person was operating as a midwife but is not licensed, we would look into that and determine whether or not they were practicing midwifery without a license. And then where we would land on the sanction may depend on the outcome and of the birth and those kinds of things. But we do need guidance about whether or not you're going, that you really want that line drawn.
Yeah. Then Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Fenimer and then Thompson again.
I have a little trouble just because this is an industry that's been going forever and hasn't been regulated or really by any means. And I'm wondering if we're going to create this new category of licensing, why don't we, and you're the nurses board, a nurse wife, you can have a midwife who's unlicensed, a nurse wife who is licensed, and just lets people who want to become a licensed where they hire somebody. But why are we attacking an industry that hasn't done anything before? Just let them go about their business and create a new category for them to get licensed.
They are licensed now. I mean, there are licensed direct entry midwives. Mm-hmm.
So direct entry midwife means you go directly into the profession without going to nursing school, and you can deliver at home. You're not allowed to deliver in hospitals.
Sweet.
And then a certified nurse midwife is somebody who's gone to nursing school and then had the additional midwifery training, and they can either deliver at home or in hospitals or birth centers.
Mm-hmm. I was just trying to make to make it easy for you, and then the unlicensed
in categories right now. And I think what you raised, Holly, is, you know, it wasn't clear to me whether you meant they can practice but not under the name, they can't advertise and can never use the term midwifery, but they can still deliver babies.
But they might not have certain privileges. They might not, for example, be able to submit birth records and death records at midwives. I mean, midwives have privileges. Midwives can carry medicines.
Right. That's right.
That's right.
Well, right now we said they can't. In our exemption, we said they can't carry life. That was one of the things in the informed consent. In our informed consent, if you're not licensed, you may not. One of the things that you would let people know is you can't carry life-saving devices because you've not.
But I was saying the same thing about midwives can do that. X people can't do that. And it isn't a matter of the outcome. It's a matter of if they're out there, people using medicine that aren't licensed midwives, then they're in violation of the law. And I don't see it as a death sentence.
So like a nurse midwife, I'm just thinking just add a name for them to fall in. And it makes a classification that makes it easy for her. So because the last thing I want is Representative Conger delivering my baby.
Well, we found when
if you're pregnant right now, I think we got a whole other conversation.
My wife's accused me of it.
Found out of Malala County that birth delivered by chiropractors, birth delivered by veterinarians. Let's see, who is next?
You're gonna get good. You know, I guess part of it is I think that you define some terms, and I think it would be broader than midwife or direct entry midwife, and you would cover a scope. I'm not sure exactly. Birth coaches, I don't know how far you want to get with this. But people would not, under that kind of a law, be able to call themselves that. They could call themselves something different. Like, for example, I could call myself a legal consultant and probably avoid the bar. And hold myself out to do a number of things. But
nobody would hire you, Bill.
But they shouldn't. But the point is that you can come up with some names, and then if people call themselves any of those names, they are violating the law, and that's subject to whatever penalties there are for such violations. And that, you know, and if you call these things yourself one of these things, then you are allowed to have these kinds of medicines. Otherwise, unless you're a licensed individual, you're not. And I think that's how that gets framed.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, I really do think we could go a long ways with educating consumers about choice and the benefit of being licensed, the benefit of being in a profession that's regulated. And I was telling Representative Kenny Geyer earlier today that Monday I have a conference call with a manager from the Public Health Division that is over health certification and quality improvement, Dana Seelover, and she and her group is responsible for certifying birthing centers. And we are involved in a lawsuit currently, our agency and the health authority, $50 million lawsuit out of Bend for a case that involved a birthing center and midwives. So we have some...
Who's being sued? The board?
The agency that... It's the state of Oregon, and it's the health authority and the health licensing agency.
And they're being sued because of what?
Because of the allegation of negligence and the fact that malpractice wasn't carried for the midwives and the birthing centers out of Bend. So it is...
I don't understand.
I'm sorry.
They're not suing them. They're suing us.
They are suing us. That's correct. They are suing us as the... They are suing the state of Oregon because we regulate midwives and the health authority certifies birthing centers. It is a liability suit. It's handled by risk management, and it's one of our ongoing lawsuits that we're concerned about. But what I wanted to do is make the point that the state as a whole has an interest in drawing some lines and making sure that we have informed consumers about the practice, about the board, about you know, what licensed midwives can and cannot do. And we can do much better with that. And before we run out of time, I do want to commit to the committee that if it is the policy decision to give the Direct Entry Midwife Board full authority in discipline and in licensing and rulemaking authority, the agency will work with them. It's not exactly the health licensing model because all of our boards are advisory boards as we speak. But perhaps this is the time to experiment with that. And many of you know about Senate Bill 302, and that was one of the pushbacks about 302 was that it took away that authority from the boards. And I think that we could work with the boards. I think originally the reason that the boards were advisory is because of the budget problem, in that the position that I'm in is responsible for the overall budget of the agency. We have three boards right now that are operating in the red. It's not just the midwives. And we are obligated to inform those boards of that and to continue to balance that from an administrative standpoint. And I think we can do it. And I think the model can work, but it does doesn't mean that boards can't have final order authority.
Sure.
That is a matter of those professions coming in and saying we're the professionals and we can make those decisions. So I just want to make sure that
oversight in that.
Pardon, sir.
You have oversight in the circumstance where the boards can make direct.
So the boards that we oversee are advisory. The final decision lies with the position, the executive director position.
Which is you.
And that's the way it is now.
That's the way it is now. This bill, one of the key things is that the board, not the agency director, would be signing the final orders on rulemaking, licensing. And on this bill, it didn't include licensing, which I thought was a bit inconsistent. If the policy decision is to go there, it seems that it would be more consistent to make this board look more like other healthcare boards, and other healthcare boards do have that authority.
Mark, I'm going to ask you to give us a few amendments, because you give us an amendment that takes that out so we can decide explicitly with an amendment whether we want the board to have the final authority or the agency. So could you give us an amendment to this bill that does what Holly just said, that does not include the final authority on the board?
So two amendments, one that takes that away, that our task force recommended, and another that adds the authority for licensing.
That's right. Both would be good for us to have. One that keeps it as other boards in the agency, and one that takes all the things away from the agency. So we have a clear-cut decision.
So there's still, maybe I can work with you all later. There's still the piece that I really hate to give up, which is informed consent for people who are practicing without a license. Mm-hmm. Informed consent.
Well,
I just feel like
if you could give us a bill, if you could give us an amendment that makes all midwives licensed midwives, and anybody who's not a licensed midwife is not a licensed midwife.
Right. So if you call them traditional birth attendants and they're delivering a baby, how do we make sure that they give informed consent? Mm. Maybe we wash our hands of it, but part of the whole intent of this was how do we protect, it's all around consumer protection. How do we better protect people and make sure that they know that there's no recourse, this is not regulated?
I don't think you can have it both ways. I think either everybody's a license and those other people aren't regulated, or
that's the risk.
They're all licensed. I mean, I don't think you can regulate somebody you're not regulating.
Right. Mark, are you thinking of becoming a midwife someday?
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Kenny Geyer, no, I am not.
do you have anything you want to add?
I just want to clarify that I wouldn't use necessarily the term advisory to explain the board's relationship to the Oregon Health Licensing Agency, and that the relationship between the two is almost like a mini executive legislative type branch where they have rulemaking authority generally, and then OLA executes administratively, according to those rules, everything it needs to do to carry out those functions.
Is that true?
That's correct, Holly.
Do they have rulemaking authority?
It varies, but most of them truly are in consultation. They are. They would not be the final signature on the rules.
Not on the orders, but on the rules statutorily.
Oh,
they do have rulemaking
authority. Same thing with rules. Huh?
Yes. So Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, most of our boards would be considered advisory boards in terms of we actually do the work. We do the administrative work, but in licensing and and disciplinary, the final decision is with the agency. So we may differ on that.
Let's have one rule. I mean, let's have one amendment that's like that.
Okay.
And one amendment that gives the final authority to for all things to the board.
Chair Greenlick,
their understanding of the truth.
It's the current. That is the current model. So we may not. It's the way it is now.
It's not the model in this bill.
New,
no, but it's not the model in this bill. So we have amend the bill that puts it back in the current rule.
Yes.
Or then amend the bill that gives the board all of the authority, and then we can have a clear cut understanding of the options.
Our understanding previously from Mark, so we can talk about this, is that you could give authority in those two areas, but that the OLA would still retain authority for licensing, because that's ultimately, we can talk about that.
We can. However, what I'm understanding from the community and the profession is that they want to look more like other healthcare boards,
right.
And other healthcare boards have that full authority across licensure, discipline, and rulemaking.
Okay.
And the one on no exceptions.
Okay.
And we'll get to vote on them.
Okay.
And then we'll vote on them and we'll pass the bill. Unless the vote means we don't have four votes.
Right.
All right. This was good. Thank you so much for all your anguish as well as for all your work.
I'm still in anguish.
Thank you.
Now we all are too. Thanks.
We are adjourned.